You're listening to the Bible for Normal People, the only God-ordained podcast on the internet. I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
Before we get started, we have a few announcements, but don't skip them. Seriously, what's wrong with you people?
Right. Stay with us. First, we have a new class coming up on May 28th with the one and only Dan McClellan called Myth Busting the Bible, where Pete and Dan will be talking about the big aha moments that change the way they see the Bible. As always, the class will be followed by a live Q&A with Dan and Pete, and the cost is pay what you can until the class ends. If you can't make it to the live class, no worries. It will be recorded so you can watch it back later. To sign up, head to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/mythbustingthebible and mark your calendar May 28th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time.
Also, please remember to pick up a copy of our children's Bible, God's Stories as Told by God's Children. It's written by over 50 contributors, including biblical scholars, theologians, and practitioners from diverse backgrounds. It's inclusive, imaginative, and deeply respectful of kids' intelligence and curiosity. You can order it today on Amazon or check out our retailers list at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/God's Stories.
And last but not least, if you've been reading God's Stories and thinking, I want my own version of this, but I don't want to carry around a kid's book, you're not alone. We heard from enough of you that we're releasing the God's Stories Adults Edition on May 20th. It's the exact same text, just without the illustrations and the conversation starters, so grown-ups can enjoy it without feeling like they've stolen their kid's book. You can learn more about this at, you guessed it, thebiblefornormalpeople.com/God's Stories.
All right, let's get into the episode.
Hey, everybody. On today's episode, we're talking about paratexts with Garrick Allen. Garrick is professor of divinity and biblical studies at the University of Glasgow.
And his most recently published book, which is the topic of this conversation today, is Words Are Not Enough, Paratexts, Manuscripts, and the Real New Testament. And we had fun with this discussion, so let's get right into it.
Paratexts are those things, they're important because they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're part of every Bible that's ever been made. These are things that are hidden in plain sight that have huge effects on the way we interpret and read texts, the way that we divide them up, the way that we see connections between them. And these are sort of the products of ancient, medieval, modern readers who want us to do certain things with these passages.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
Well, Garrick, welcome to the podcast. It's wonderful to have you.
Happy to be here, guys. Thanks for the invite.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to blow all of our listeners' minds today because we're talking about...
We usually do, though.
That's
think
true.
About it.
That's
it's
just
more so.
Every day. But, come on, I was trying to set Garrick
on the regular.
I was trying to set him up as this special and unique thing, and you just...
But he is. He's
tanked
unique.
It. Okay. You just tanked. Anyway.
More.
We want to talk about paratexts. And I think this is going to be a new concept for a lot of our listeners. So let's just start with the basics. What is a paratext and what are some examples? Kind of let's lay the table for the concept before we get started.
Let's do it. Yeah, let's. I think we are going to take it to a new level today. So I'm fully on board with
that's
that.
That's what I like to hear.
You know, paratext, writing and thinking about paratext a lot the last few years is as a challenge because it's a term that most biblical scholars have never heard of or used or played around with. So you know, one thing I always have to do is sit and just try to explain in simple terms what paratexts are. So, I mean, from my perspective, paratexts are everything around a text beyond the text itself. So everything from page numbers, footnotes, annotations, corrections, front matter, indices, bibliographies, cross-references, any sort of thing in a book beyond the text itself. So paratexts are great because they are universal from the ancient world on to today. There are paratexts in nearly every manuscript or copy of a literary text that we have. And they're also highly specific to particular traditions. So there are paratexts specific to the New Testament or dictionaries or phone books. I'm old enough to remember phone books. And the New Testament is great because it has been so important to so many communities from the first century onward that it garnered a huge amount of paratexts and a number of features that help people to do certain things with the book, to navigate between parallel passages in the Gospels, to understand the quotations that Paul makes in his letters, and so on. So there's actually a lot of material to work with, and this book really only starts to scratch the surface of these things.
Can you, I'm curious, do chapters and verses count as paratexts?
Absolutely. Text divisions. There are dozens of different systems for dividing the Bible's text, the New Testament in particular, from the first century onward. And chapters and verses are only a relative newcomer from the 16th century. So these things that we take for granted as ingrained parts of what the Bible is, you can say a number, John 3:16, and know what the text is. This is a relatively new phenomenon. And it's building off a much longer tradition of ways to divide and make sense of these passages.
Yeah. I mean, before we get into a lot of specifics, I can imagine people for whom this is a completely new concept. And by the way, you know, you said before, even biblical scholars, it's absolutely true. I went through 5 years of doctoral work in Hebrew Bible, albeit, but I never heard the term. I never saw it written. It was nowhere. And then you start thinking about it. It's like, oh my goodness gracious, there's, you know, there's much more going on than just the text, right? So absolutely. Just maybe just very briefly, without giving everything away, like, why should anybody care about page numbers? And who cares? Come on, man. Are you just some scholar trying to make stuff up, you know, and trying to make yourself seem
important?
You got to
get a PhD on something.
Are you in league with Satan? That's really the question I'm trying to ask you.
Everyone's got to be good at something. I'm good at making stuff up. So that's what I'm trying to do here. No, I mean, you know, paratexts are those things. They're important because they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous. They're part of every Bible that's ever been made. These are things that are hidden in plain sight that have huge effects on the way we interpret and read texts, the way that we divide them up, the way that we see connections between them. And these are sort of the products of tradition, not the biblical authors for sure, but of ancient, medieval, modern readers who want us to do certain things with these passages. And when we attend to them and see them in the first place, we can understand how the Bibles we read are trying to get us to do certain things with them. Mm-hmm. So, and once you see paratexts and all of their variety and all their functions and the things that they do, you can't unsee it when you read anything. Mm-hmm. So once you can see the margins, the liminal space that these things inhabit, you can make sense of it. I mean, Gerard Genet, who coined this term in the 1980s, talking about French literature, sees this as a sort of place of transaction between the text and the author and readers, with tradition as a sort of liminal space in between, a space where things happen, where readers see the text anew, where they understand themselves better. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's actually a really good concept for thinking about what the Bible is, how it works, what the Bibles that we hold in our hands do to us as we engage them.
Well, good news. That's what we do at the Bible for Normal People. So you're in the right place. Well, can we, I don't know if we want to go to some specific examples for specific reasons, but I think it's still a little bit abstract for people. So can you give some examples that would indicate why it matters? And I'm thinking especially of maybe chapters and verses or titles, and how that can actually make a difference in terms of how people read their Bibles.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you pick up any two modern Bibles, the thing you'll notice is that, you know, modern publishers play with paratext to appeal to new audiences. Mm-hmm. So let's say you wanted to read, one of the examples I use in the book is reading Matthew 24, the apocalyptic discourse, where Jesus is talking about the temple's destruction and everyone should run for the hills on this day and so on. If you read it in the Scofield Reference Bible, like the best-selling book in the history of Oxford University Press, you will read that passage like a roadmap to the end of the world, because Scofield was a dispensationalist who thought the end of the age was very near, and you could track what Jesus says onto particular things that are happening in his day. But if you read Matthew 24 in the Green Bible, which highlights all of the texts about creation care and care for the world and environmentalism in green, you'll be more attentive to patterns of deconstruction, the decreation of the world that Jesus is describing, this chaos around famine and the birth pangs of the earth and so on. Mm-hmm. So these paratexts attune you to really focus on different aspects of these passages and to interpret them in different ways. These are parts of every Bible you read, every English Bible for sure, and every manuscript of the New Testament that we have in one form or another. And you can't get away from them. So we might as well cast an eye on them and see what they're trying to make us do.
And what strikes me about these titles, you know, I think on some level, they're almost presented as an objective kind of thing. Like, here's what this next few verses are about. But they're also highly rooted in tradition, right? And
absolutely.
Right. And that affects how we read it. And therefore, it's important.
That's right. I think titles are an interesting case. I mean, they are one of the clearest products of tradition that become ingrained into what we think the Bible is, whether that's the chapter numbers or the little subtitles you find in modern Bibles or in the manuscripts. But we've been working on a project here, you know, kind of apart from the book, where we've edited every form of every title in every Greek New Testament manuscript. Mm. There are over 30,000 entries. And these books are called all sorts of different things. The Book of Revelation has 54 different Greek titles.
Really?
Absolutely. In the tradition.
No.
So, yes.
No.
Some talk about Patmos, where John was, what he was doing there, the vision he saw, which John it was, all these sorts of things. And so, you know, these titles really shape what people are doing.
Yeah.
Whether you see, you know, 1 Timothy as a letter or as a book, that matters. You see both of these words in the manuscripts and in modern Bibles, whether it's Paul or St. Paul, these sorts of things influence our view of the author and the authority of their text and what they're trying to say.
This is just sparking a memory here. And in the Hebrew Bible, in terms of titles mattering, I think it's in chapter 21, there are a list of laws about property. If your cow does this to your neighbors, then this will happen. And then there's this little break. There's this subtitle saying, social laws. And the first one is, you know, if a man seduces a virgin, you know, he still has to give the bride price to the father, you know, if he doesn't want her to marry her. And the thing is that that's not a social law. That is property law that goes with it. It's an if-then law. It's right there. But to break it up, because we can't have our Bible saying that, you know,
women are property.
Yeah, exactly. Virgin daughters
exactly
are property.
Right,
exactly. And it's like, first time I saw that, I was like, wow, this shouldn't be here. This
right.
it's ruining it. You know, it's plain old wrong. But it's that's the way it is, because you have to, you're marketing in a sense. You're selling something to people.
Absolutely. I mean, the modern Bible industry is a huge paratexts are marketing tools for them. I mean, Bibles underwrite a lot of the other books that we write as scholars, and so, you know, that makes some sense. But you see these sorts of things, even like the household codes in Ephesians. You have the rules that Paul talks about between slaves and masters, and then there's a subtitle, and then it's about wives and children and so on. And these things are divided off from one another. And what's interesting is, in your modern Bibles, in most versions, the subtitles are made up by modern editors. So these are devised by the people who are trying to market these Bibles to particular audiences, to have people understand them in certain ways. But that tradition goes back all the way to the 3rd, 4th century, where people are inserting subtitles into the New Testament. Yeah. It's just that the ones that we're presenting to people aren't necessarily the ancient ones.
And I see with, and maybe you guys have other examples of this too, where the chapters and verses, well, are also pointing to particular interpretations and meanings of things. For me, I immediately think of Jonah, where there's certain parts where the story seems to keep going for a couple of verses. It's like the climax of the story might be in chapter 2, verse 6, or like, you know, the first couple of verses. And it's like, well, why did they put the chapter there and marking that off? So even there, I think as scholarship has progressed, more and more those have gotten it. In some ways, I kind of, because of my way I think, I'm like, we should go back and maybe change some of these chapters and verses here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think you see it in Revelation chapter 10. There's a clause at the end of that verse. It's unclear if it goes with the end of chapter 10 or the start of chapter 11. These things are pretty common. Or what do you do with the four endings to Mark? How do you present these things in the Bible? What do you do with the woman caught in adultery in John 7 and 8? I mean, how do you frame these troublesome passages off from one another? And these are all sort of paratextual choices we make to present the text to people.
Do any, this is getting really specific, but do any in the book of Ecclesiastes, do we have paratexts that would set off the bookended editorial?
The epilogue. Yes,
the epilogue. Yeah. There are some that will,
and they say different things too. And a lot of them. I mean, I'm trying to remember what some of them are, but like I think some miss the whole point.
Right.
Frankly,
yeah,
that's interesting.
You know? Yep. And I don't know. I don't know this example off the top of my head, but the Masorah for the Hebrew Bible, this medieval, very intricate, a set of marginal annotations around a manuscript that create cross references that point out the middle word in a book that talk about variant readings, all these sorts of things. They're this really widespread paratextual system for the Hebrew Bible from the 10th century onward that is hugely influential.
And those are more statistical, right? They're not really necessarily trying to, it's not marketing. It's more a way of trying to establish
that's right.
Preservation of the text.
That's right. I mean, none of these until the modern Bible publishing industry in the 19th century are marketing devices. They're about helping people to do certain things with it, to read the text in Orthodox liturgy, to, understand the relationships between the four gospels or whatever.
Yeah.
It's only when you get to the modern day that you get ever increasingly niche paratexts designed for particular audiences. Yeah. The American Patriot Bible, Donald Trump's, strange Bible, Bible for women,
that's
small
the official
groups
name,
and
actually.
Teens and so on. So, right.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And even the innocent ones, just putting in chapter numbers, just Genesis Absolutely. 1 and 2, the first story, that break is made like four verses too early.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But that happens, and that affects people. And as a professor of college students, it's like, why are you stopping? Why do you keep going into chapter 2, verse 4? Why do you do that? Well, that's because the context seems to demand it, actually, But somebody was too much mead. I don't know what these scribes were doing, but they put, they put the two in there far too early.
I mean, our modern chapter and verses mostly go back to a 16th century French printer who printed one of the first Greek Bibles that we have, Stephanus. And so this system, there's other versions similar to it, but it really becomes popular with his early edition of the Greek New Testament. And we haven't looked back.
Yeah.
Okay. Can we zoom out a little bit? Because
yes.
I want to talk about these, Bible for normal people. What is the Bible? So what are some of the questions that get raised as you start studying these paratexts and seeing how they are integrated or influencing tradition and the text itself in some ways? What are the questions that come up when we ask, what is the Bible when it comes to paratexts?
Yeah. I mean, this is the main question of the book. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to grapple conceptually with what the Bible is when you consider the entirety of its transmission. So, as a kid who was not super religious and went to church on Easter and Christmas, you think of the Bible as a floating text out in the penumbra that someone snatches down and prints in a book and is accessible to you.
What is a penumbra?
It's like the ether, the stuff in the air. I don't know. It's a dumb word. but it's something that's floating out there that a really smart person can get hold of and give to you. When in fact, I think, when you look at the manuscripts and you look carefully at the history of the Bible, it's words are obviously very important, but it's more than just words. It's a big set of features that is text, that is material, that is paratext, that is this dance between scripture and tradition and the people engaging it. And this process, to my mind, is defined by change. This is the main argument of the book, that the best way to describe the New Testament is something that is constantly in flux in this negotiation between readers, the past, people who played a role in bringing the Bible to us. But that the important thing is that this change doesn't undermine the fact that the Bible might be sacred or revelatory or important. It's a symptom of the fact that communities have viewed the Bible as revelatory and important and valuable and worth passing on, that change becomes part of its essential substance.
Yeah. Well, Garrick, you mentioned just a few seconds ago material.
Yeah.
As a paratext. And I think I know what you're after, but could you explain that? Because, I mean, I get chapters. I get that. You know, subtitles. Yeah. I get that. You know, all weird stuff like explanatory notes or little inserted essays, you know, in some study Bibles. That I get that. But what the material? Who cares?
Yeah, I think the material is kind of on the boundary, I think, of a paratext. But I think it does have, you know, the material does communicate to us. So as a manuscript scholar, you know, I'm firstly interested in material to understand who made the book, why and when, what is it made out of? Is it paper or parchment or papyrus? What are its dimensions? What kind of binding does it have? Who did it? You know, who has repaired it over time? So I want to understand the people who, you know, made and used this thing. So from a historical perspective, that's one thing I'm interested in. But the materiality also communicates, like a little pocket Bible is something quite different than a family Bible that you put all your family's heirlooms in and wedding invitations and all that stuff like my grandmother does. You know, that's a monument to our family that is mediated in this weird sort of sacred space that's this big sort of closed book monument. But a messy copy of a text on poor paper, you know, doesn't say the same sort of thing. It communicates something different. Like if you look at modern Bibles, for example, like the Scofield Bible again, which I had to buy a copy of for this book, came in its own fancy box in its own little case with a gold leaf around the edges and a gold, you know, bookmark and all this sorts of fancy stuff that communicates that this is something important, valuable, sacred, whatever. But the Green Bible is, you know, printed on paper that makes you think like someone just scraped it off a tree because it's recycled and the quality is much lower, but it communicates that, look, we're trying to do, take care of God's creation. So you should buy this book in the first place. So the material does, you know, communicate to us what something is for. Like a dictionary looks different than, a journal article or a newspaper. And a newspaper, you know, is ephemeral, and a dictionary is something you have on your shelf for a long time. So these sorts of things matter. How big is the margin? You know, do people, are you supposed to write notes in it? Is the script clear and beautiful? Is it messy and fast? Like these sorts of things matter for understanding what that particular book is trying to do.
Or even what verses are footnoted. I mean, even something
That's right.
Yeah. It's just like, oh, this must be really important or something like that.
That's right.
What about, I mean, the transition to electronic Bibles, which I hate, just because I'm old and I just can't do it. If I don't have pages in my hand, I don't care if it's a leaf, gold leaf or not. I just need pages to turn. But I'm wondering if, I mean, going all the way back to scrolls, transitioning to books, transitioning to now electronic forms of reading, and those are all material parrot texts, right?
And just absolutely.
I mean, I'm not asking for a big answer here, but just it seems like that it affects how you read it.
I mean, I agree completely. I mean, one thing I touch on briefly in the book, but don't give too much time to, is this idea that the media, the shape of the book matters. So it changes from scroll to codex, and from manuscript to printed book, and from printed book to digital text, going back to kind of a scroll up and down style of reading. You know, these do have fundamental impacts on how people read, period, how they read sacred texts. But of course, digital text has its own paratextual possibilities with hyperlink and all sorts of things that Eusebius was experimenting with the codex in the fourth century. as well, these forms of hypertext and flipping back and forth within a book. So, you know, the digital texts have their own sort of materiality, but they're not all that entirely different from things that people have played with throughout the history of the Bible.
You mean like Eusebius, you mean like a concordance kind of thing, or just...
Yeah, so Eusebius made a very cool thing. I have a chapter or two on it in the book called the Eusebian Canon Tables. And what he did was he gave each like sentence or section in the Gospels a number. So this is before chapter and verses. So in Matthew, there's a few hundred sections, you know, in John, there's less and so on. But then he took those numbers and put them on a set of tables to see where the Gospels agree on certain sections.
Oh, okay.
So the first table is where all four Gospels have a passage. You know, the second table is where Matthew, Mark, and Luke agree. The 10th one is where they all have individual passages. And if you have these tables and the numbers in the book, which most Greek Gospels have, you can flip between passages and compare them without breaking up the narrative of the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like a built-in concordance or a that's not the right word, but
cross-reference, or maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Like where you parallel. Can compare.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a way to do parallel readings without actually moving around the gospel text. And it's really complicated and really hard to transmit and produce, but there are hundreds of manuscripts with this system in it. So, you know, the digital text where you can flip back and forth between parallels with a click is not that dissimilar.
Well, oh, and another one, just not double-columned. But I mean, I think Zondervan came out with a Bible a few years ago. I'm not sure how if it's still in production. But it's like, no, this is wrong. It's just lines. It's like a regular book. I don't even know what to do with this. You know, I want the columns. That's what I'm used to, right? And it affected how I read it.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that's right. I mean, you know, Eusebius wants you to be able to read the Gospels front to back if you want, but to be able to flip back and forth and compare them all you want as well.
Mm-hmm.
There is a number of Bibles like this that are no chapter and verses, just text, and they want you to read it like a novel front to back, which is a fine way to read, but it's certainly not the only way to read these passages. So I'm fine with experiments like this. I think it's really interesting and jarring to see how our readings differ when the paratextual ecosystem changes. I think when you look at stuff like that, that's where you see the power of, you know, sort of the secret hidden power of these paratexts.
When you were talking about the first person in France in the 80s to come up with this concept, I immediately thought of Jacques Derrida, who in his own way was playing with these same questions, right? What is a text? I think he has a text called Glass or something, GLAS1S, that like really upset the academy in France at the time, sort of like playing with the idea of what is a text. So that made me think of, you know, for me, one of the big takeaways of what you said is tradition is a part of the text in some important ways. Like you can't get away from it. It's always a part of it. How do you, you talked about you being interested. It doesn't sound like you're more of a conservative thinker in this way where it's like, well, let's get back to the real basics. Let's strip all the paratexts away. So as you think more creatively or interestingly, what are ways that you've thought of, if you have, to incorporate more of the playfulness or the creativity of the paratext as a way to maybe pull out different parts of the biblical text in ways that I think we've talked about it in ways that can go kind of awry, where it's like, well, you're just kind of inserting your own interpretation. But if it's unavoidable, and we're not saying let's try to get rid of that, what's a vision for how to maybe help us do it responsibly, where the tradition just is going to be a part of it?
Yeah. I mean, there is no literature without paratext, I'm convinced. I'm convinced there's no Bible without paratext. So we have to understand what has come before and what we're doing as readers and publishers and scholars when we're engaging this material. So it's not something that we can ignore or strip away in its entirety. Like scripture and tradition are fully intertwined. Right. They need each other. And I think that's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one thing I do in some of my classes is I'll show different English Bible versions of the same passage or different manuscripts of the same passage with wildly different paratexts and have students break into groups and try to interpret and see what's going on and come back in the group. And they come back with wildly different things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I think if you're a serious Bible reader of any kind, you're reading the Bible for any reason, I recommend reading different versions. If you're just reading English Bibles, that's great. Pick up different ones. Learn from the traditions of the past, and you can even learn from bad paratexts in the present if you're aware of their influence and what they're trying to do. So right. I'm very open for publishers, scholars, artists to continue to think paratextually about the Bible and other texts, and to invent new things, to try to do new things, to experiment. This is part of the process. But you also want to call out really bad ones like the American Patriot Bible that puts the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights and a bunch of astronaut sayings and quotes from astronauts in the Book of Revelation for some reason. So all these very odd sorts of things, like, they may be for some people, but they do more harm than good. So we need to be critical still. But I think experimentation has been part of the process of the Bible from the ancient world onward. And when we do this, we're part of that really long process, and we can empathize with and imagine the lives of the many anonymous scribes, readers, annotators, people who left small traces of themselves in these manuscripts that have helped to produce the Bibles that we hold in our hands today.
Well, it seems like a great object lesson for this abstract thing that we talk about a lot, which is, you know, some people say they don't interpret their Bible, they just read it. And so this is a very concrete example of from the paratexts themselves, even if, you know, just to say it wouldn't be true even if you just had the words, but you don't just have the words. You have interpretive traditions built into the Bible that you have right in front of you, which seems like really tangible and maybe easier for people to grasp in this conversation. So I think it's been a great conversation just to have paratext as sort of a tool to help people understand these bigger ideas of Bible reading.
Even things, I mean, just tables of contents, opening essays, you know, I mean, all these things, it's just
absolutely,
it's intended to steer the reader, which is not a bad thing in and of itself, but it's intended to steer the reader toward understanding. But that's very much a constructed reality at that point.
Fully, that's fully the case. And I think, you know, paratexts, when you can see them, then what they're doing, you also begin to see what sort of traditions and experiences we all bring to the text as human beings who are grappling with some of these questions. Yeah. They help us to understand ourselves, to attend to the sort of liminality of our daily lives, to get new views, new perspectives on the biblical text, but also on a range of other experiences that we have as human beings out in the world, in relationship with people, doing things, and to see, at least for me, helps me to see the world afresh a bit.
You know, I can imagine some people listening to this and saying, I'm just going to throw my Bible out now because I think it's just all full of things that I'm not even aware of, blah, blah. So here's a nice practical question. Do you have a go-to English Bible?
Oh, I don't.
Of course you don't.
I only read the Greek and Hebrew.
I read a lot of different English Bibles. It depends on what I'm trying to do. Don't throw your Bibles away. This book is actually arguing the opposite, that all of this seeming instability is part of the wonder of it all, and it's something to keep engaging with. But I mean, so if I'm doing a class, I often use the NRSV because that's what we use on this side of the pond. But if I'm,
which has standard subtitles for them. I mean,
yeah, exactly. They're made up by editors. They're produced by the editors of the NRSV, but they're there, and they have chapter and verses, and they have notes on, important variant readings in the Greek and Hebrew and things like that. So that's useful for students. But when I'm trying to read Bible stories to my kids at night, I'm reading the Mennonite, Peace Table Children's Bible to them, because it's a nice, kind of gives a nice story to it. So, or if I'm going to go teach a class on apocalyptic literature, I might read the Jewish annotated New Testament, Jewish annotated study Bible or something like this to, you know, so, or if I'm going to go to Vespers at the Orthodox Cathedral in Glasgow and Father Marcos is going to ask me something, I might read the Orthodox study Bible or something like this. So I think, you know, the more Bibles we read with the different types of paratexts, that gives you a larger perspective on the possibilities out there, and you'll see things that you've not thought of before.
Yeah.
So it's not get rid of your Bible, it's buy more of them.
Buy more of them.
Yeah. Yeah. Borrow more.
Well, yeah. And it's not, you know, well, the Bible says, well, the Bible is, first doesn't say anything, you have to interpret it, but it's all happening within a context as well that is setting you up. Again, I don't mean that in a negative sense. It's just,
yeah,
it's laying groundwork that is nuanced and not obvious maybe to many people, just little things like subtitles. I mean, when I teach a class and we're reading something, I say, does anybody have a little subtitle here? And it's amazing how different they are from different translations. And they really do communicate different things, and they lead to certain expectations of that text that actually might not even let you ask maybe the right or at least good questions of this text, because it almost takes that away from you at the outset. That's a negative impact on it. But yeah. So
I mean, it's not positive or negative. It just is. I mean, this is part of the inescapable humanness of reading. We bring ourselves, we bring the sort of hidden things around the text into what we're doing. And this is part of the process. Like, I've talked to some students, you know, we have a very mixed group of students here, but some say, well, like, if the Bible can be made to say anything, what are we even doing here? And my response is, you know, we have to engage it in all its complexity and take it for what it is. And if the Bible is revelatory, if the Bible is inspired or important in some way, then we have to let it be what it is in all of its complexity.
It may just, as we draw this to a close here, I'm fascinated. You have a quote, and we don't have to get into all of it because we've touched on a lot of this already, but from your book, you say the New Testament is a diverse set of narratives and letters that have been remade each time they're copied and printed, right? I mean, yes. Do you want to expand on that a little bit more in a different angle maybe?
I think the main argument is that, you know, whenever you make something, it reflects its makers in some way, shape, or form. And something as complicated as the Bible is, you know, you're required to make hundreds of small choices about how to present this thing, what size font to use, what kind of paper, do you use chapter and verses, how do you divide the books and sections, what prefaces do you give, how many footnotes do you do, which famous biblical scholar can you get to write the preface to the whole thing, you know, all of these choices, and they're not unlike the choices that every scribe made in copying a manuscript from, you know, second century onward. They're a set of choices that we often make without thinking about their impact, that are made for a whole range of purposes. Some, you know, really conceptual and theological about what the Bible is. Some, you know, political. You don't want to be talking about laws about wives and children under the auspices of property. Or technological, like, you know, the books that we make are you know, influenced by how cheap something is to make, how fast you can make it, what the audience is, all of these sorts of things come into play. And when you hold a Bible in your hand, it's the product of thousands of choices of dozens or hundreds of people spanning centuries. And it's a real like treasure trove of human experience trying to engage the divine.
Yeah.
And you can empathetically think about the people who touched these manuscripts, who left their mark in them. I mean, one of my favorite examples is there's a gospel manuscript at the Chester Beatty Library in Dublin that has a little prayer in the lower margin of just randomly in the middle of Luke somewhere. And it's a guy who calls himself Peter the Shoemaker, and he prays for his wife Anastasia and their children. So we don't know who he is, when he lived, where he was, but it's the only tangible record of this person's life. And when we see the Bible as something that we only hold a part of when we hold a book in our hands, we can start to think more broadly about the other people who came before us trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, there is a tradition You know, I mean, the biblical tradition, it's not just the text, but the tradition that involves all these things like paratext and whatnot.
And just a reminder, I mean, a reminder that a tradition is also generations after generations of people engaging this text and the faith that it, you know, bears witness to. So,
absolutely.
Well, that's, I think, a great way to end the conversation. So thank you, Garrick, for jumping on and for sharing your passion with us, at least the passion for the last couple of years. You may be moving on and ready to talk about something new soon, but thank you so much.
Someday, we'll see.
Well, thank you.
I appreciate it, guys. It was very fun. Thanks,
Garrick. Yep.
Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free live stream of the podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebiblefornormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of The Bible for Normal People. Don't forget, you can catch our other show, Faith for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team. Brittany Hodge, Stephen Henning, Joel Limbowen, Savannah Locke, Melissa Yando, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Lauren O'Connell, and Naomi Gonzalez.